This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. We want to get into a story that talks about how for years America's most upbeat retailer funded surveillance to make inner cities safe for some. And now it's done a bit of a 180 trying to convince people of color that it's changed. Let's get more on Target's cozy police legacy. Bloomberg News Projects and Investigations reporter Peter Waldman joining us from San Francisco with this story that he did with Lauren Etter. Peter, an incredible read. I said this should be a documentary after I read it. Tell us what's been going on at Target.
Sure. Thank you very much. Lauren and I undertook a piece about essentially what Target has been doing over 20 years or so, where they have kind of aimed their own internal surveillance mechanisms on the neighborhoods around some of their stores and been very cozy with police, funding surveillance systems, cameras, integrated data systems where people can report things, and a lot of it is just speculation, but it always has IDs and license plates and all kinds of information about people in streets and other places who may or may not have committed any crime. As you mentioned, they are doing a 180 now. In the last year, Target has been extremely decisive about embracing the racial justice movement, and they've committed some $2 billion to supporting black entrepreneurs and talking to a lot of community groups about how they manage their stores, particularly in the inner cities. But we show in this week's cover story in Bloomberg Business Week that they really spent, I don't know, the first 15 years of this century quite closely allied with police departments all over the country and spending a lot of money helping them with this whole surveillance situation.
Peter, was it the murder of George Floyd in May of 2020 that was the inflection point for Target? And we should know this is a company based in Minneapolis. The city is core to the company's DNA. And just the fact that the murder happened so close to Target.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point. After the murder, just days afterwards, the CEO and chairman of Target, Brian Cornell, issued a statement saying his team literally wept at the lack of progress on racial justice issues, and certainly the response and uprising in Minneapolis was the catalyst for that response from Cornell. I will say, though, that Target began retreating from its most active programs, spending money and developing partnerships with police departments around the country back, around 2014, 2015, also, as you will recall, a noted moment in the Black Lives Matter movement with the killings in places like Ferguson. And in response to all of that, Target seemed to really change tack and has spent more of its law enforcement money and energy and philanthropy on things like Shop with a Cop programs, which have police take underprivileged kids shopping at Targets around Christmas time and other more community-oriented events. So I would say that the 180 began several years ago, but there is no doubt that the pace has picked up dramatically over the last year.
You include a lot of individuals, or some specific individuals, I should say, in your story. Tell us about William Mende.
Sure. William was one of many, many, many young people, mostly of color, on the streets of Minneapolis, as you mentioned, Target's hometown, where they did their most intensive programming around law enforcement and what we call, or I should say support of what we call broken windows policing, which is that doctrine that says you have to arrest people for any kind of petty infraction, whether it's riding bikes on sidewalks or loitering, littering, urinating, you name it, if they cite these young, generally young people or others on the streets, then they won't, they'll get the idea and won't commit more serious crimes. So Target was, as were many companies and I should say police departments, very involved in supporting that effort going back into the 2004 through, let's say, 2015 time frame. And William was, you might say, someone caught up in that. He was arrested many, many times inside the so-called Target Safe Zone, which is this area of about 40 blocks in downtown Minneapolis, where they literally went on this extremely aggressive, I should say, the police went on this extremely aggressive arrest campaign using surveillance cameras to spot kids. We quote a defense attorney, the public defender of Minneapolis at the time, saying that they were sure that the police were all watching monitors to just find some reason, find some suspicion on people in the street to come out and search them and arrest them for minor offenses. This all goes back to, as I said, the money that Target spent on setting up the safe zone in downtown Minneapolis. William, I will just conclude by saying, was someone caught up in that and then became went to work on the social services side and attended the meetings of all kinds of people, including county attorneys and others, that were trying to help these kids. But he described attending that meeting as being an invisible person at a KKK meeting. He was not impressed with their sincerity in helping people on the streets of Minneapolis.
Hey, Peter, this is all happening against a backdrop of the way that municipalities and police departments are trying to deal differently with one another, and citizens calling for police departments to act differently and throw out the traditional handbook. How has law enforcement reacted to the recalibration, as you put it, that Target and Brian Cornell are doing right now?
So I can tell you that in Minneapolis, they've been extremely responsive. Minneapolis, as you can imagine, is a police department on its knees since the killing of George Floyd, some 14 months ago. They have had a very serious attrition, people not wanting to go to work or leaving that police department. And they have been willing and eager to work with Target on reform ideas. One of them, and we got a lot of documents from public records requests from the police, was to replace or retrain off-duty police officers who work as security officers at one major Target there in Minneapolis. And the ideas were, you know, as progressive sounding as could be in terms of, you know, even discussing whether or not they were even wanted armed police in the store. And there was an idea that they could possibly replace off-duty police security with community groups who would engage in sort of nonviolent or de-escalation of violence and kind of ease people or shoplifters out of the store, giving them food and being much more empathetic than your typical Minnesota cop,
right,
or Minneapolis cop. So I think the Minneapolis police are working very closely with Target. Target's offering some $700,000 in awards with the U.S. Council of Mayors to find communities that are really doing this racial justice work and policing. So we'll see how that pans out.
Well, I have to say, it was really unexpected, your story. And I think that's safe to many people who are listening right now and who go and read it in the magazine this week. It is the cover of the domestic issue of Bloomberg Business Week this week. I'll put it out on Twitter, but go to Bloomberg.com or BusinessWeek.com or pick up the magazine because it's incredible.
It's a deep dive also into Target's history, the political connections that the family of the company has had with the state of Minnesota and the culture as well.
Yeah, exactly. Bloomberg News Projects and Investigations reporter Peter Waldman writing that story with Bloomberg's Lauren Etter. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. It's Wednesday. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the news came across this morning, and I think it hit people pretty hard. It was something that I was seeing everybody talk about on Twitter this morning. It's coming from Delta Airlines, the company telling workers, get that COVID shot or else you got to pay up $200. And I think what's so fascinating about this, Carol, is it's being positioned because costs go up for the company if you get COVID and you have to be hospitalized.
So it's a cost issue.
That's how Delta CEO Ed Bastian, I read, is positioning it.
All right. Well, let's see what Mary Schlangenstein has to say. She covers the airlines, the U.S. airlines, for us here at Bloomberg News. She's on the phone from our Dallas bureau. Mary, so glad that you could be with us. So tell us what's going on at Delta and what's their reasoning behind it.
Well, what Delta is saying is that they've had 75% of their employees get vaccinated to date, but they want that number to get higher. And so they had to provide some sort of a incentive or a penalty, and they chose to go the penalty route. If you don't get vaccinated by November 1st and you're part of their health care plan, your monthly costs will go up by $200 a month.
So it's not that, okay, so what they're doing, though, is they're not making it mandatory that everybody gets a vaccine, correct?
Right, they're not mandating it.
Okay, but if you don't get it, you're going to be penalized.
Right, it's going to cost you. So it's not going to cost you your job like at United Airlines, but it's going to cost you in the pocketbook. And apparently they felt like this was the best route for them to go to get the best response from their employees. The only thing that they said was that they were confident that doing it this way would get them above the 75% vaccination level.
This covers pilots, it covers flight attendants, it covers ground crews. What are the details?
It does not cover pilots because earlier this year, Delta negotiated an agreement with its pilots in which it agreed not to require the pilots to be vaccinated at least until November 1st.
What's up with that, Mary?
It was what the pilots wanted to do with the company. Several airlines have negotiated these agreements, and what they did was they provided incentives for the pilots to get vaccinated. And so that was a way for them early on in the pandemic to make sure the pilots got vaccinations by providing incentives for them to do so. And as a result, the union got the company to agree not to, order them to get a vaccine.
I want to talk a little bit about how much it costs for the company to pay for somebody who is hospitalized. The average hospital stay for COVID-19 patients has cost Delta $50,000 each. I did say earlier $40,000, so I wanted to correct myself. But tens of thousands of dollars, Mary, in order to take care of somebody who's been hospitalized with this. Does the $200 a month extra in a premium, is that going to cover that increased cost?
I don't think it's going to cover the increased cost, but I think they aren't looking at it quite in that way. I think the way they're looking at it is that they believe that's enough to encourage people to get the vaccinations. And if they get the vaccinations, then the number of employees hospitalized will fall off. And from that standpoint, it'll lower their costs.
In terms of the airline industry overall, are each of them kind of looking at one another, Mary, to kind of get some guidance on what is the right policy here?
Well, I think what they're trying to do is they're all trying to figure out what's the best way to approach their own workforce. Now, we've got United, as we said, mandating you must get it, Delta going this route. American and Southwest are still saying at this point that they are strongly encouraging their employees to get vaccinated. But I think you're right in that they're taking a close look. They're all now debating, what's the best bet for us going forward? What's the most effective strategy for us? Because they do want to get employee vaccination rates up high because they are, a lot of them, running short staff this summer.
You know what is so interesting about this, Mary, is that Delta was one of the airlines that blocked middle seats during the earlier parts of this pandemic. And I did see anecdotally that people said, hey, wait a second, I want to fly on Delta because I feel like it's not as crowded. I won't be as close to somebody. I'm wondering how much of this is about telling its customers that they're taking this seriously.
Well, I think that's probably part of it. And there were a lot of comments on Twitter today where people said, look, I was going to have to book a flight in a couple of weeks. I'm going to book Delta because of this, even though, it's not going to take effect by then. But there were several people stepping up and saying, this convinces me I'm going to fly on Delta.
Just want to mention shares of Delta are up 1.7% today. That's after a 3.4% jump on Tuesday, yesterday, and almost 3% higher on Monday. So we are seeing it trade higher throughout the week. Hey, Mary, always good to check in with you. She is a must-read when it comes to the U.S. airline industry. Mary Schlangenstein, U.S. Airlines reporter at Bloomberg News, on the phone from our Dallas bureau. That's the kind of thing I would take. I would look at an airline and say, okay, they're making it mandatory that everybody has to have vaccines.
Yeah, you're not the only one, Carol. That's certainly something that people are doing.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we mentioned some of the COVID and vaccine headlines. Among them, Pfizer and BioNTech seeking full U.S. approval for a COVID vaccine booster shot. You've got J&J saying a booster of its COVID-19 vaccine provided a rapid and strong increase in antibodies. Tim, I think a ninefold increase in COVID-fighting antibodies, to be exact.
Yeah, the company is going to discuss the booster time frame with health officials. Well, let's get to all this and more with Dr. Bill Moss, professor of epidemiology at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, also executive director of the International Vaccine Access Center, joining us on the phone from Baltimore. The Bloomberg School of Public Health is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Dr. Moss, it is really great to have you on the program with us. Carol and I have been talking a lot lately about the rising number of cases that we're seeing across the United States, especially in hotspots, particularly in the South, where hospitals right now are certainly overflowing. Given the spread of the Delta variant, especially in the last few weeks, where do you think we are with the end of the pandemic?
Yeah, thanks, Tim, for having me back. And, you know, we're still have a long way to go before the end of the pandemic. Mm. And our number one priority is really has to be vaccinating the unvaccinated. We also have other tools in our toolbox. We have the basic public health measures, but we need to be focused on vaccinating the unvaccinated, particularly in those hotspots that you referred to, some of the states in the South. We are seeing an uptick in vaccination rates there. That's a good thing. But we still have a long ways to go to get us through. And you know, there are a lot of concerns about kids going back to school and then the colder weather bringing us indoors and bringing other respiratory viruses as well.
That is something, Dr. Moss, I'm wondering about if come fall we're going to see a repeat of what we saw last fall.
Yes, it won't be the same as what we saw last fall. And I think, you know, the big news is that, you know, particularly are the most vulnerable among our communities, adults older than 65 years of age, they have very high vaccination coverage. More than 90% have received at least one dose, about 80%, you know, fully vaccinated. So we shouldn't see, you know, the real dire situation that we saw last year. Those vaccinated adults, older adults, should be protected against severe disease and hospitalization. But we may still see an increase in cases if we don't get our vaccine coverage up and if we don't practice some of our basic public health measures.
So do you support companies rolling back, bringing people back to their offices, talking about masks, and many even stepping up and saying, if you want to come back to the office, you need to be vaccinated? Is that all of those steps crucial, Dr. Moss, in terms of really us getting ahead of this health pandemic?
Yes, I think they are crucial, Carol, and because, you know, if we bring people together who are unvaccinated without those basic public health measures like mask wearing, particularly indoors, that's what's really fueling the surge. So I, you know, and as you said, as Tim said, you know, we have now a full FDA approval for the Pfizer vaccine. I think we'll see that for the Moderna vaccine in a couple of weeks. And that has kind of opened the door for more companies, both private and public, to issue vaccine mandates.
Well, the troubling thing, I think, for many parents right now, especially of young kids, is that tens of millions of Americans aren't even eligible to receive vaccines yet. And those include all children in the United States under the age of 12. What is a realistic timeline for parents, for us, for me, to be thinking about when, you know, my 2.5-year-old can actually safely get a vaccine?
Yeah, this is a really important question. And obviously, the return to school makes this even more urgent. What we're going to see, Tim, is first an authorization for children 5 years to 11 years of age. That's going to be the next phase of age group that will be eligible for vaccination. It will be with the Pfizer vaccine first, because they are kind of ahead in terms of the timing of the studies and the timing of the review process. We're hoping to begin to see, you know, the data from Pfizer late September, early October, and then there's going to be a review process. So unfortunately, I don't expect that we'll see children 5 to 12 years, 11 years of age getting vaccinated until probably October, you know, maybe even into November. So we'll be the first
more than a year from now.
School year.
More than a year from now.
Oh no, I'm sorry. From this year. Sorry.
Oh, so that's actually relatively quick time frame.
A couple months.
Okay. Yep. What about for kids under 5?
Yeah, that's where that's going to be a little later. Those studies are underway. We'll probably see, again, in phases, approval 2 years to 5 years of age, and then after that, 6 months to 2 years of age. That's not going to happen until probably first or second quarter 2022. Mm-hmm. That will be next year.
So in phases. Okay. So, I don't know, look into your crystal ball a year from now. What's our world like? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, I think a year from now, we should be in a much better place. Certainly in the United States, we should, you know, have achieved a much higher vaccination coverage. And to be honest, Carol, what will happen is those who are unvaccinated will get infected sooner or later.
Right.
The global scale, we're still going to have a long way to go, unfortunately, even a year from now. COVAX, that's providing vaccines, is hoping to be able to provide 2 billion doses by February. That's going to be a big boost. We're at 5 billion doses total, but we need to get up to about 11 billion or so globally, and we're still far from that. Hopefully we'll be closer a year from now, but I think we'll still have a ways to go in many countries.
Dr. Moss, do we realistically get to a point in a few years where we don't think about this each and every day in the way that we've been thinking about it, and we instead think about it seasonally, perhaps like we think about the flu? We get a flu shot every year. Well, half of American adults do, half of Americans do, and then kind of like don't look backward, right?
Right. I think we will get to such a point. You know, the unknowns here are really about how much how many more tricks the virus has, I'll say, you know, in terms of, you know, changing its genetic code and really evading immune responses. If we don't see that, if we've kind of maxed out on that, then I think we'll be in a much better place. Mm. If this virus still has more tricks and can really evade our immune responses, we'll be in a much better place, but we'll have to kind of, the vaccine manufacturers will have to make new vaccines targeted to those new variants, and we'll have to be revaccinated.
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. Great to check in with you. Thank you so much for your time. Dr. William Moss, he's Executive Director of the International Vaccine Access Center, Professor in the Departments of Epidemiology, International Health, and Molecular Microbiology and Immunology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, of course, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, chief executives from across the business world at the White House today, we mentioned this earlier, they are meeting with President Biden on how industry and the federal government can partner to improve cybersecurity in the face of debilitating ransomware and cyber attacks. So let's get some thoughts on that. Let's bring in our next guest. He's Tony Anscombe. He is chief cyber threat officer at ESET. It's an IT security software and services firm. He is on the phone in California. Hey, Tony, nice to have you here with Tim and myself on Bloomberg Radio. What should we want to hear out of today's meeting between business leaders and the president?
I think what we need to hear is some clear action. And if there was one thing I'd like to hear from my side, actually, that it's we're going to take the monetization out of cybercrime. However, that is a very complex issue to grasp as well for them today.
How do you do that? How do you take the money out of cybercrime?
Well, I mean, there's been much discussion around banning ransomware payments, or at least controlling them. But
can you do that?
Can
you do that if a company gets attacked and they, you know, they're told, okay, for, you know, 200 Bitcoin, we'll leave you alone. Can the U.S. government really say you can't have that option?
Well, that option is already there in certain instances where cyber criminals may already be on the Office of Foreign Assets Control sanction list. It's actually illegal to pay them, and it will be illegal for cyber insurance to be involved in that, and the banks and cryptocurrency exchanges to make those transactions as well.
So let's go back to what you hope is the dialogue maybe between the president and the business leaders who are at the White House. What do you hope that they're discussing, and what do you hope maybe is the outcome?
Well, I think one of the big things in there, as President Biden opened the meeting, he talked about the G7, the 30 nations. So he's understanding this is a very international issue, and it's good to see that he's got some very large tech companies and international companies around the table. But he also talked about the skill shortage, that there's 500,000 cybersecurity jobs that are unfilled. And that's a huge issue for the industry of how you actually get another generation of cybersecurity professionals into the industry so that you can actually have the right skill sets and resources in companies to protect themselves.
What is that skill set? What do we need to see in terms of people being trained for this industry, which is a rapidly growing one, and we know becoming a necessity, increasingly so, at all kinds of companies, institutions, organizations?
Well, cybersecurity is a is an evolving and changing industry. If we go back a number of years, it was maybe about reverse engineering or looking or researching certain types of threat. But today, it's also about analytics and understanding data and then investigation into threats. So these issues continually evolve, and you know, having people coming through the university system with degrees in cybersecurity or complementary degrees around that sector is super important. I recently spoke to one university student who was struggling to get a job, until, even though they got a degree in cybersecurity, until they got a commercial certification. So I think some companies are not trusting the university programs either.
Tony, you live and breathe this as Chief Cyber Threat Officer at ESET, and I'm wondering, how concerned should we be that we'll wake up one day and not be able to access some certain essential, whether it's a financial institution, a utility, water, that we need to access because of a cyber threat, because of a hack?
Well, as we've just seen with Colonial Pipeline, the ransomware attack that happened on them suddenly took down, you know, essential supply of gas and caused long lines at gas stations. So I think this was a wake-up call for people that actually it can affect daily life. This is not just about picking up looking at the latest news story and saying, oh, another data breach or another cyber attack, that actually these cyber attacks can have real effect. And we've seen this historically with the likes of Indestroyer and Black Energy in the Ukraine, where cyber criminals took out parts of the power grid on two different occasions.
Hey, just one last question, Tony. Just got about 35, 40 seconds here. The financial crisis, the health pandemic, climate change reminds us that we need to work globally to tackle some of these macro problems. Cybersecurity in mind, what kind of global collaboration do you think is needed when it comes to cybersecurity? And again, just got about 30 seconds.
Well, it's a global issue. And actually, I'd like to see this under a much broader banner. And I'm pleased to see that President Biden was including discussion about the G7 and NATO organizations. This is not a single nation issue.
We're going to leave it on that note, and a great way to wrap it up. Tony, thank you so much. Tony Anscombe, Chief Cyber Threat Officer at ESET, as I mentioned, an IT security software and services firm, talking about that meeting between President Biden and a bunch of leaders when it comes to cybersecurity.
Yeah, you just have to hope that, you know, the experts are one step ahead of the hackers.
Fingers crossed, elbows crossed.
Everything's crossed.
Everything's crossed. You're listening to Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Keep driving crazy.
Just drive, baby.
Keep driving crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
Drive away, take a break, we can reach our destination.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
TikTok, everyone.
TikTok.
TikTok on this crazy Wednesday. And we've been talking about intraday, you know, more records on those major equity averages. We're bouncing around. We're just off our highs of the day, so we'll see where we are by market day. And let's get to our market guest, our Drive to the Close. Well, Walter Todd is with us.
Yeah, joining us now is Walter Todd, President and Chief Investment Officer at Greenwood Capital Associates. Joining us on the phone from Greenwood, South Carolina. Walter, how are things right now for you in Greenwood, South Carolina?
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for having me, guys. We're good. I mean, we're dealing with the same issues everybody else is in terms of surge of cases and hospitalizations, but the latest numbers look like those are peaking, and got kids back in school. I got three in college and one in high school. So they're in person classes, which is a nice change from last year. So we're doing okay.
Well, talk to me about how you think we're seeing all of this manifest right now in the equity markets, because I did speak with Lizanne Saunders at Charles Schwab earlier in the day today, and she made the really interesting point that we really have to look at this data on a, you know, state by state basis, on a locality by locality basis. And like, she referred to open table data and hotspots that show a dramatic decline in people eating at restaurants versus what you look at nationwide, because this is a story of hotspots. Tell me how you think that's manifesting in the markets right now.
Yeah, so, I mean, you definitely, like you say, you're seeing it in the TSA numbers, you're seeing it in the open table numbers, but I think the market kind of has reflected this over the past 2 months. I mean, it really started at the beginning of June when the 10-year kind of rolled through 160 and headed to 112. So I think actually the market's kind of on the other side of this and anticipating a peak in cases and hospitalizations over the last couple of days. We just started to see the 10-year pick up. It's back over the 200-day moving average. We started to see kind of the sector performance shift. You know, Dave Wilson could have rolled in with the Birds' Times They Are A-Changin'.
Nice yeah, little time. Okay,
right? Same album, 1965. But so we're seeing a little shift, and we think the markets kind of the past 2 months have kind of reflected where we are today, but looking forward, kind of coming out of this as we head to the fall.
Bubble? Any signs of a bubble? Things getting frothy that make you a little nervous?
Yes, to answer that shortly. You know, different corners of the market, when you look at certain metrics like price to sales and some of these software names, you know, Snow, I know Snowflake's reporting after the close, that stock trades at 66 times sales. So you definitely see this in corners of the market, but there's still, we think, a lot of value out there in other areas that have been hit over the past couple of months in the more cyclical parts of the market, like in financials and energy, materials and industrials. So we do want to have a balance between the cyclical and the secular growth, but we think right now, if we're putting money to work, it'd probably be more in these cyclical areas versus the secular.
Give us some specifics if you can.
Yeah, so again, no recommendations to purchase or buy or sell, but what stocks we own for our clients. You know, in the energy space, for example, we like the other FANG, Diamondback Energy, which is sold off pretty aggressively here. Baker Hughes is another one we own in that space. In the industrial side of things, Raytheon we think is a very attractive, cheap name in that area. And then the semis have been hit pretty hard. I know NVIDIA has done great by itself, but underneath the surface, we own Western Digital, which is getting a nice pop today on some M&A chatter. So we think semis outside of some of the higher priced ones are attractive as well.
Hey, Jackson Hole, are we going to get anything out of it that you think will make investors think maybe a little bit differently about Fed policy?
I don't think so. I mean, I think when they went virtual, I think that kind of took the edge off of what Powell's maybe going to say. I do think he's going to try to set the table for the expectation that in September they're going to announce that they're going to maybe start in November. I think that's he's going to try to lay that out, but I think he's going to
announce tapering in November.
I think they are hoping to be able to do that. I think he's going to say we've got to wait and see what the data with the Delta variant. We have seen some softer economic numbers. He'll definitely reference that. But I think they would like to get on with the process of starting to taper.
So set the stage in September gently to say we're going to probably taper and then actually start tapering come November?
Yes.
Okay.
So start tapering come November, you know, maybe $15 billion a month. That would take them about 8 months to get to zero on the purchases. But the balance sheet is going to continue to grow.
Right.
They're going to be reinvesting, you know, maturities and so forth.
What do you see happening to the bond market and the equity market, if that indeed, like, are the equity and bond markets prepared for that type of announcement?
Yeah. Well, you know, bonds theoretically should, the yield should move higher, you know, when that is announced. But they've done so much kind of prep work and handholding to get to this point, and issuance is going down. I'm not sure that bond yields are going to go as high as maybe people would think in theory. From a stock perspective, no doubt we'll probably see some volatility as this, you know, plays out over the next couple of months. But I think as long as the economic backdrop remains healthy and the earnings, we haven't talked about earnings growth, which have been phenomenal. I think as long as those stay firm, you know, the market can maybe take a correction from this and then recover and move higher.
I mean, is there any skepticism in the market right now, do you feel like, based on the equity trade that we're seeing?
Not a lot,
yeah.
And that's a very good point. You know, the consensus is, and certainly the, you know, people feel very confident in buying these dips. We haven't been below the 50-day moving average for quite some time, almost a year now, and we haven't seen a 5% correction. Very rare to go a year without that. So definitely there's a lot of confidence in the market, so that could lead to some volatility as we get these announcements from the Fed in the months ahead.
Well, and speaking of announcements, I mean, the corporate earnings announcements, I mean, that is one mega bright spot for the most part overall. Of course, there are individual, you know, surprises to the downside, but that has continued to really outperform. What are your thoughts on corporate earnings going forward?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that the market's actually cheap, even though the market's up, S&P's up 20%, it's actually on a PE basis is cheaper than it was at the beginning of the year because earnings have been so strong. So they're definitely going to moderate, obviously. We're looking at up 40% on a year-over-year basis right now for 2021. But, again, we can moderate in the rate of growth, but as the numbers continue higher and they don't peak into 2022, I think that's still a good backdrop, a good support to not get too much of a drawdown. Maybe you get 5 to 10% again in the fall, traditionally a volatile period of the year. But as long as those earnings continue to move higher, even though the growth rate is slowing, I think that's a good fundamental support for a lot of the market.
Hey, Walter, are you telling customers or advising your clients right now to have money on the sidelines for some pullback?
Yeah, so with new money that's coming in client accounts or new accounts, we're certainly not putting all of that to work, you know, at once. So we are, you know, kind of bracing for a little bit of volatility around the budget. We haven't talked about the debt ceiling fight that could be coming, the Fed announcement. So there are some things out there on the horizon that could cause some volatility and give you opportunities, you know, to buy individual names cheaper. So we're looking to be opportunistic from that standpoint.
All right, going to leave it on that note. Hey, Walter, be well. Enjoy the rest of the summer. Walter Todd, President and Chief Investment Officer over at Greenwood Capital Associates, on the phone from Greenwood, South Carolina, joining us once again on Bloomberg Business Week.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.